port fees were tripled. Certain goods were to be taxed both coming into and out of the city, and new levies were asked of innkeepers and builders. None of these measures had the desired effect of filling up the treasury vaults. Instead, building slowed to a halt, the inns emptied, and trade declined notably, as merchants diverted their ships from King's Landing to Driftmark, Duskendale, Maidenpool, and other ports where they might evade taxation. Lannisport and Old Town, the other great cities of the realm, were also included in Lord Celtigar's new taxes, but there the decrees had less effect, largely because Casterly Rock and the High Tower ignored them and made no effort to collect. The new levies did, however, serve to make Lord Celtigar loathed throughout the city. Lord Rogar and Queen Alyssa received their share of opprobrium as well. Another casualty was the Dragon Pit. The Crown no longer had the funds to pay the builders, and all work on the Great Dome ceased. Storms were gathering to both north and south as well. With Lord Rogar occupied in King's Landing, the Dornishmen had grown bold, raiding more frequently into the marches, even troubling the Stormlands. There were rumours of another Vulture King in the Red Mountains, and Lord Rogar's brothers, Boris and Garen, insisted they did not have the men and money required to root him out. Even more dire was the situation in the north. Brandon Stark, Lord of Winterfell, had died in 49 AC, not long after his return from the Golden Wedding. The journey, the Northmen said, had asked too much of him. His son Walton succeeded him, and when a sudden rebellion broke out in 50 AC amongst the men of the Night's Watch at Rhinegate and Sable Hall, he gathered his strength and rode to the wall to join the leal watchmen in putting them down. The rebels were former poor fellows and warriors' sons who'd accepted clemency from the boy king, led by Sir Oliver Bracken and Sir Raymond Mallory, the two turncloak knights who had served in Maegor's Kingsguard before abandoning him for Jaehaerys. The Lord Commander of the Watch, unwisely, had given Bracken and Mallory command of two crumbling forts, with orders to restore them. Instead, the two men decided to make the castles their own seats and establish themselves as lords. Their uprising proved short-lived. For every man of the Night's Watch who joined their rebellion, 10 remained true to their vows. Once joined by Lord Stark and his bannermen, the Black Brothers retook Rhinegate and hanged the Oathbreakers, save for Sir Oliver himself, who was beheaded by Lord Stark with his celebrated blade, Ice. When word reached Sable Hall, the rebels there fled beyond the wall in hopes of making common cause with the wildlings. Lord Walton pursued them, but 2 days north in the snows of the Haunted Forest, he and his men were set upon by giants. It was written afterward that Walton Stark slew 2 of them before he was dragged from his saddle and torn apart. His surviving men carried him back to Castle Black in pieces. As for Sir Raymond Mallory and the other deserters, the wildlings gave them a cold welcome. Rebels all know the free folk had no use for crows. So Raymond's head was delivered to Eastwatch 30 years later. When asked what had befallen the rest of his men, the wildling chieftain laughed and said, "We ate them." Brandon Stark's second son, Alaric, became the Lord of Winterfell. He would rule the North for 23 years, an able man, though a stern one. But for a long while he had no good to say of King Jaehaerys, for he blamed the king's clemency for his brother Walton's death, and was oft heard to say that his grace should have beheaded Maegor's men rather than sending them to the wall. Far removed from the troubles in the north, King Jaehaerys and Queen Alysanne remained in their self-imposed exile from the court, but they were anything but idle. Jaehaerys continued his rigorous training regimen with the knights of his King's Guard every morn, and devoted his evenings to poring over accounts of the reign of his grandsire Aegon the Conqueror, on which he wished to model his own rule. Dragonstone's 3 maesters assisted him in these inquiries, as did the Queen. As the days passed, more and more visitors made their way to Dragonstone to talk with the King. Lord Massey of Stone Dance was the first to appear, but Lord Staunton of Rook's Rest, Lord Darklyn of Duskendale, and Lord Bar Emmon of Sharp Point came hard on his heels, followed by the Lords Hart, Rollingford, Mouton, and Stokeworth. Young Lord Rosby, whose father had taken his own life when King Maegor fell, turned up as well, sheepishly pleading for the young king's forgiveness, which Jaehaerys was pleased to grant. Though Daemon Valerian, as the crown's Lord Admiral and Master of Ships, was in King's Landing with the regents, that did not prevent Jaehaerys and Alysanne from flying their dragons to Driftmark and touring his shipyards, escorted by his sons Corwin, Jorgen, and Victor. When word of these meetings reached Lord Rhaegar in King's Landing, he grew furious, and went so far as to ask Lord Daemon if the Valerian fleet could be used to prevent these Lord's Lickspittle from crawling to Dragonstone to curry favour with the boy king. Lord Valerian's reply was blunt. "No," he said. The Hand took this as a further sign of disrespect. Meanwhile, Queen Alysanne's new ladies-in-waiting and companions had settled in on Dragonstone, and it soon became apparent that her mother's hope that these wise women might persuade the little queen that her marriage was unwise and impious had gone seriously awry. Neither prayer, sermons, nor readings from the seven-pointed star could shake Alysanne Targaryen's conviction that the gods had meant her to marry her brother Jaehaerys, to be his confidant and helpmate and the mother of his children. "He will be a great king," she told Septa Isabel, Lady Lucinda, and the others, "and I will be a great queen." So firm was she in her belief, and so gentle and kindly and loving in all else, that the Septa and the other wise women found they could not condemn her, and with every passing day they clove more to her side. Lord Rhaegar's own plan to drive Jaehaerys and Alysanne apart fared no better. The young king and his queen were to spend their lives together, and though they would famously quarrel and part later in life, only to reunite, Septon Oswick and Maester Caliper both tell us that never a cloud nor harsh word troubled their time together on Dragonstone before Jaehaerys reached his majority. Did Corianne Wilde fail to bed the king? Is it possible that she never made the attempt? Is the whole tale of the meeting at the inn mayhaps a fiction? Any of these are possible. The author of A Caution for Young Girls would have it otherwise, but here that infamous text becomes even more unreliable, splintering off into half a dozen contradictory versions of events, each more vulgar than the last. It would not do for the wanton at the heart of that tale to admit that Jaehaerys had rejected her, or that she never found the opportunity to lure him into a bedchamber. Instead, we are offered an assortment of lewd adventures, a veritable feast of filth. A wanton's tale insists that Lady Corianne not only bedded the king, but also all seven members of the king's guard. His grace supposedly gave her to Pate the woodcock after he had sated his own lusts. Pate passed her to Ser Geoffrey in turn, and so it went. The High and the Low omits these details, but tells us that Jaehaerys not only welcomed the girl into his bed, but also brought Queen Alysanne in to frolic with them in episodes most often associated with the infamous pleasure houses of Lys. A somewhat more plausible tale is told in Sins of the Flesh, wherein Corianne Wilde does indeed lure King Jaehaerys into her bed, only to find him fumbling, uncertain, and overhasty, as many boys of his age are known to be when first abed with a maid. By that time, however, Lady Corianne had grown to admire and respect Queen Alysanne as if she were my own little sister, and had developed warm feelings for Jaehaerys as well. Instead of attempting to undo the king's marriage, therefore, she took it upon herself to help make it a success by educating his grace in the art of giving and receiving carnal pleasure, so that he might not prove incapable when the time came to bed his young wife. This tale could well be as fanciful as the others, but it has a certain sweetness to it that has led some scholars to allow that it might, mayhaps, have happened. Lewd fables are not history, however, and history has only one sure thing to tell us about Lady Corianne of House Wild, the putative author of A Caution for Young Girls. On the 15th day of the 6th moon of 50 AC, she departed Dragonstone under the cover of night in the company of Sir Howard Bullock, the younger son of the commander of the castle garrison. A married man, Sir Howard left his wife behind him, though he took most of her jewellery. A fishing boat carried him and Lady Corianne to Driftmark, where they took ship for the free city of Pentos. From there they made their way to the disputed lands, where Sir Howard signed on to a free company called, with a singular lack of inspiration, the Free Company. He would die in Mir 3 years later, not in battle, but in a fall from his horse after a night of drinking. Alone and penniless, Corian Wilde moved on to the next of the trials, tribulations, and erotic adventures recounted in her book. We need hear no more of her. By the time word of Lady Corian's flight with her purloined jewels and purloined husband reached the ears of Lord Rogar in the Red Keep, it had become obvious that his plan had failed, as had Queen Alyssa's. Piety and lust had both proved unable to break the bonds between Jaehaerys Targaryen and his Alysanne. Moreover, word of the king's marriage had begun to spread. Too many men had witnessed the confrontation at the castle gates, and the lords who had called at Dragonstone afterward had not failed to notice Alysanne's presence at the king's side, or the obvious affection between them. Rogar Baratheon might talk of tearing out tongues, but he was helpless against the whispers that spread throughout the land, and even across the narrow sea, where the magisters of Pentos and the sellswords of the Free Company were doubtless entertained by the tales Corian Wilde had to tell. "It is done," the Queen Regent told her counsellors when she realized the truth at last. "It is done and cannot be undone. Seven save us. We must needs live with it, and we must use all our powers to protect them from what may come." She had lost 2 sons to Maegor the Cruel, and a coldness lay between her and her oldest daughter. She could not bear the thought of being forever estranged from the 2 children who remained to her. Rogar Baratheon could not yield as gracefully, however, and his wife's words woke in him a fury. In front of Grand Maester Benefer, Septon Mateus, Lord Valerian, and the rest, he spoke to her contemptuously. "You are weak," he declared. "As weak as your first husband was, as weak as your son. Sentiments may be forgiven in a mother, but not in a regent, and never in a king. We were fools to crown Jaehaerys. He thinks only of himself, and he will be a worse king than his father was. Thank the gods that it is not too late. We must act now and put him aside." A hush fell over the chamber at those words. The Queen Regent stared at her lord husband in horror, and then, as if to prove that he had spoken truly, began to weep, her tears running silent down her cheeks. Only then did the other lords find their tongues. "Have you taken leave of your senses?" asked Lord Valerian. Lord Corbray, commander of the city watch, shook his head and said, "My men will never stand for it." Grand Maester Benefer exchanged a glance with Prentice Tully, the Master of Laws. Lord Tully said, "Do you mean to claim the Iron Throne for yourself, then?" This Lord Rogar denied vehemently. "Never! Do you take me for a usurper? I want only what is best for the 7 kingdoms. No harm need come to Jaehaerys. We can send him to Old Town, to the Citadel. He's a bookish boy. A maester's chain will suit him." "Then who shall sit the Iron Throne?" demanded Lord Celtigar. "Princess Arya," Lord Rogar answered at once. "There is a fire in her Jaehaerys does not have. She is young, but I can continue as her hand, shape her, guide her, teach her all she must know. She has the stronger claim. Her mother and father were King Aenys's 1st and 2nd born. Jaehaerys was 4th. His fist slammed against the table then, Benefer tells us. "Her mother will support her, Queen Rhaena, and Rhaena has a dragon." Grand Maester Benefer recorded what followed. A silence fell, though the same words were on the lips of us all. "Jaehaerys and Alysanne have dragons too." Carl Corbray had fought in the battle beneath the god's eye, had witnessed the terrible sight of dragon fighting dragon. For the rest of us, the hand's words conjured visions of old Valyria before the doom, when Dragon Lord contended with Dragon Lord for supremacy. It was an awful vision. It was Queen Alyssa who broke the spell through her tears. "I am the Queen Regent," she reminded them. "Until my son shall come of age, all of you serve at my pleasure, including the hand of the king." When she turned to her lord husband, Benefer tells us that her eyes looked as hard and dark as obsidian. "Your service no longer pleases me, Lord Rogar. Leave us and return to Storm's End, and we need never speak again of your treason." Rogar Baratheon looked at her incredulously. "Woman, you think you can dismiss me? No," he laughed. "No." That was when Lord Corbray rose to his feet and drew his sword, the Valyrian steel blade called Lady Forlorn that was the pride of his house. "Yes," he said, and laid the blade upon the table, its point toward Lord Rogar. Then, and only then, did his lordship realize that he had gone too far, that he stood alone against every man in the room, or so Bennifer tells us. His lordship said no further word. His face pale, he stood and removed the golden brooch that Queen Alyssa had given him as a token of his office, flung it at her contemptuously, and strode from the room. He took his leave of King's Landing that very night, crossing the Blackwater Rush with his brother Orin. There he lingered for 6 days, whilst his brother Ronal assembled their knights and men-at-arms for the march home. Legend tells us that Lord Rogar awaited their coming in the selfsame inn beside the ferry where he, or his brother Boris, had met with Corianne Wilde. When the Baratheon brothers and their levies finally set out for Storm's End, they had barely half as many men as had marched with them 2 years before to topple Maegor. The rest, it would seem, preferred the alleys and inns and temptations of the great city to the rainy woods, green hills, and moss-covered cottages of the Stormlands. "I never lost so many men in battle as I did to the flesh-pots and ale-houses of King's Landing," Lord Rogar would say bitterly. One of those lost was Aerya Targaryen. On the night of Lord Rogar's dismissal, Sir Ronald Baratheon and a dozen of his men forced their way into her chambers in the Red Keep, intending to take her with them, only to find that Queen Alyssa had stolen a march on them. The girl was already gone, and her servants knew not where. It would be learned later that Lord Corbray had removed her at the Queen Regent's command. Dressed in the rags of a common girl of the lowest order, with her silver-gold hair dyed a muddy brown, Princess Aerya would spend the rest of the regency working in a stable near the King's Gate. She was 8 years old, and loved horses. Years later, she would say that this was the happiest time of her life. Sad to say, there was to be little happiness for Queen Alyssa in the years to come. Her dismissal of her husband as the Hand of the King had destroyed any affection that Lord Rogar might ever have felt for her. From that day forth, their marriage was a ruined castle, an empty shell haunted by ghosts. Alyssa Valerian had survived the death of her husband and her 2 eldest sons, a daughter who perished in the cradle, years of terror under Maegor the Cruel, and a rift with her remaining children, but she could not survive this, Septon Barth would write, when he looked back upon her life. It shattered her. Contemporary reports from Grand Maester Bennifer agree. With Lord Rogar gone, Queen Alyssa named her brother, Daemon Valerian, as Hand of the King, dispatched a raven to Dragonstone to tell her son, Jaehaerys, some, but not all, of what had occurred, and then retired to her chambers in Maegor's Holdfast. For the remainder of her regency, she left the rule of the 7 kingdoms to Lord Daemon, and took no further part in public life. It would be pleasant to report that Rogar Baratheon, once back at Storm's End, reflected on the error of his ways, repented his mistakes, and became a chastened man. Sadly, that was not his lordship's nature. He was a man who knew not how to yield. The taste of defeat was like bile in the back of his throat. In war, he would boast, he would ne'er lay down his axe whilst life remained in his body, and this matter of the king's marriage had become a war to him, one he was determined to win. One last folly remained to him, and he did not shrink from it. Thus it was that in Old Town, at the mother house attached to the Starry Sept, Sir Orin Baratheon appeared suddenly with 12 men-at-arms and a letter bearing Lord Rogar's seal, demanding that the novice Rhaela Targaryen be turned over to them immediately. When questioned, Sir Orin would say only that Lord Rogar had urgent need of the girl at Storm's End. The ploy might well have worked. But Scepter Carolyn, who had the door of the mother house that day, had a spine of steel and a suspicious nature. Whilst placating Ser Orin with the pretext of sending for the girl, she sent instead to the High Septon. His High Holiness was, mayhaps fortunately for both the child and the realm, asleep, but his steward, a former knight who had been a captain in the warrior's sons until they were abolished, was awake and wary. In place of a frightened girl, the Baratheon men found themselves confronted by 30 armed septons under the command of the steward, Caspar Straw. When Ser Orin brandished a sword, Straw calmly informed him that 20 of Lord Hightower's knights were on their way. A lie, as it happened, whereupon the Baratheons surrendered. Under questioning, Ser Orin confessed the entire plot. He was to deliver the girl to Storm's End, where Lord Rogar planned to force her to confess that she was the actual Princess Aria, not Rayla. Then he meant to name her Queen. The Father of the Faithful, a man as gentle as he was weak of will, heard Orin Baratheon's confession and forgave him. This did not prevent Lord Hightower, once informed, from throwing the captive Baratheons into a dungeon and dispatching a full account of the affair to both the Red Keep and Dragonstone. Donal Hightower, who had rightly been named Donal the Delayer for his reluctance to take the field against Septon Moon and his followers, seemed to have no fear of offending Storm's End by imprisoning Lord Rogar's own brother. "Let him come and try to prize him free," he said when his maester worried about how the former hand might react. "His own wife took his hand and cut his balls off, and soon enough the king will have his head." Across the width of Westeros, Rogar Baratheon fumed and raged when he learned of his brother's failure and imprisonment. But he did not call his banners, as many had feared. Instead, he fell into despair. "I am done," he told his own maester glumly. "It is the wall for me, if the gods are good. If not, the boy will have my head and make a gift of it to his mother." Having sired no children by either of his wives, he commanded his maester to draft a will and confession, wherein he absolved his brothers Boris, Garen, and Ronald of having played any role in his wrongdoing, begged for mercy for his youngest brother Orin, and named Ser Boris as heir to Storm's End. "All I did, and all I tried to do, was for the good of the realm and the Iron Throne," he ended. His lordship would not have long to wait to know his fate. The regency was almost at an end. With the former hand and Queen Regent both wounded and silent, Lord Daemon Valerian and the remaining members of the Queen's Council ruled the realm as best they could, saying little and doing less, in the words of Grand Maester Benefer. On the 20th day of the 9th moon of 50 AC, Jaehaerys Targaryen reached his 16th name day and became a man grown. By the laws of the Seven Kingdoms, he was now old enough to rule in his own right, with no further need of a regent. All across the Seven Kingdoms, lords and small folk alike waited to see what kind of king he would be. A Time of Testing. The Realm Remade. King Jaehaerys I Targaryen returned to King's Landing alone, on the wings of his dragon Vermithor. 5 knights of his King's Guard had come before him, arriving 3 days earlier, to ascertain that all was in readiness for the king's arrival. Queen Alysanne did not accompany him. Given the uncertainty that surrounded their marriage and the fraught nature of the king's relationship with his mother, Queen Alysa, and the lords of the council, it was thought prudent that she remain on Dragonstone for a time with her wise women and the rest of the King's Guard. The day was not an auspicious one, Grand Maester Benefer tells us. The skies were grey and a persistent drizzle had fallen half the morning. Benefer and the rest of the council awaited the King's coming in the inner yard of the Red Keep, cloaked and hooded against the rain. Elsewhere about the castle, knights and squires and stable-boys and washerwomen and scores of other functionaries went about their daily chores, pausing from time to time to glance up at the sky. And when at last the sound of wings was heard and a guardsman on the eastern walls caught sight of Vermithor's bronze scales in the distance, there came a cheer that grew and grew and grew, rolling past the Red Keep's walls, down Aegon's high hill, across the city and well out into the countryside. Joharis did not land at once. Thrice he swept over the city, each time lower than before, giving every man and boy and barefoot wench in King's Landing a chance to wave and shout and marvel. Only then did he bring Velmithor down in the yard before Maegor's Holdfast, where the lords were waiting. "He had changed since last I saw him," Bennifer records. "The stripling who had flown to Dragonstone was gone, and in his place was a man grown. He was taller than before by several inches, and his chest and arms had filled out. His hair was flowing loose about his shoulders, and a fine golden down covered his cheeks and chin, where before he had been clean-shaved. Eschewing all kingly raiment, he wore salt-stained leathers, garb fit for hunting or riding, with only a studded jack to protect him. But on his sword-belt he bore Blackfyre, his grandsire's sword, the sword of kings. Even sheathed, the blade could be mistaken for no other. A shiver of fear went through me when I saw that sword. Is there a warning there?" I wondered, as the dragon settled to the ground, smoke rising from between his teeth. "I had fled to Pentos when Maegor died, frightened of what fate awaited me under his successors, and for an instant as I stood there in the damp I wondered whether I had been a fool to return." The young king, a boy no longer, soon dispelled his Grand Maester's fear. As he slid gracefully from Vermithor's back, he smiled. "It was as if the sun had broken through the clouds," reported Lord Tully. The lords bowed before him, several going to their knees. Across the city, bells began to ring in celebration. Joharis pulled off his gloves and tucked them into his belt, then said, "My lords, we have work to do." One luminary had not been present in the yard to greet the king. His mother, Queen Alyssa. It fell to Joharis to seek her out in Maegor's Holdfast, where she had secluded herself. What passed between mother and son when they came face to face for the first time since the confrontation on Dragonstone, no man can say. But we are told that the queen's face was red and puffy from weeping when she appeared a short time later on the king's arm. The dowager queen, a regent no more, was present for the welcoming feast that evening, and at numerous other court functions in the days beyond that. But no longer did she have a seat at council sessions. "Her grace continued to do her duty by the realm and her son," Grand Maester Bennifer wrote, "but there was no joy in her." The young king began his realm by remaking the council, keeping some men and replacing others who had proved unequal to their tasks. He confirmed his mother's appointment of Lord Daemon Valerian as Hand of the King, and retained Lord Corbray as the commander of the city watch. Lord Tully was thanked for his service, reunited with his wife Lady Lucinda, and sent home to Riverrun. To replace him as Master of Laws, Joharis named Albin Massey, Lord of Stonedance, who had been amongst the first men to seek him out on Dragonstone. Massey had been forging a maester's chain at the Citadel only 3 years earlier, when a fever had carried off both his older brothers and his lord father. A twisted spine condemned him to walk with a limp, but as he said famously, "I do not limp when I read, nor when I write." For Lord Admiral and Master of Ships, his grace turned to Manfred Redwine, Lord of the Arbor, who came to court with his young sons Robert, Rickard, and Ryam, squires all. It marked the first time the Admiralty had gone to any man, not of House Valerian. All King's Landing rejoiced when it was announced that Joharis had also dismissed Edwell Celtigar as Master of Coin. The king spoke to him gently, it was said, and even praised the leal service of his daughters to Queen Alysanne on Dragonstone, going so far as to name them two treasures. The daughters would remain with the queen thereafter, but Lord Celtigar himself left for Clor Isle at once, and with him went his taxes, every one of them struck down by royal decree 3 days into the young king's rule. Finding a suitable man to take Lord Edwell's place as Master of Coin proved to be no easy task. Several of his advisers urged King Joharis to appoint Lyman Lannister, supposedly the richest lord in Westeros, but Joharis was disinclined. "Unless Lord Lyman can find a mountain of gold under the Red Keep, "I do not know that he has the answer we require," His Grace said. He looked longer at certain cousins and uncles of Donal Hightower, for the wealth of Oldtown derived from trade rather than the ground, but the uncertain loyalties of Donal the Delayer when faced with Sept and Moon gave him pause. In the end, Jaehaerys made a far bolder choice, reaching across the narrow sea for his man. "No lord, no knight, not even a magister, Rego Draz was a merchant, trader, and money-changer who had risen from nothing to become the richest man in Pentos, only to find himself shunned by his fellow Pentoshi and denied a seat in the Council of Magisters because of his low birth. Sick of their scorn, Draz gladly answered the king's call, moving his family, friends, and vast fortune to Westeros. To grant him equal honour with the other members of the council, the young king named him a lord. As he was a lord without lands, sworn men or a castle, however, some wit about the castle dubbed him the Lord of Air. The Pentoshi was amused. If I could tax Air, I would be a lord indeed. Jaehaerys also sent off Septon Mateus, that fat and furious prelate who had fulminated so loudly against incestuous unions and the king's marriage. Mateus did not take his dismissal well. "The faith will look askance at any king who thinks to rule without a septon by his side," he announced. Jaehaerys had a ready answer. "We shall have no lack of septons. Septon Oswyck and Scepter Isabel will remain with us, and there is a young man coming from Highgarden to see to our library. His name is Barth." Mateus was dismissive, declaring that Oswyck was a doddering fool and Isabel a woman, whilst he had no knowledge of Septon Barth. "Nor of many other things," the king replied. Lord Massey's famous remark that the king required three persons to replace Septon Mateus in order to balance the scales was likely uttered shortly after, assuming it was uttered at all. Mateus departed 4 days later for Oldtown. Too corpulent to sit a horse, he travelled in a gilded wheelhouse attended by 6 guardsmen and 12 servants. Legend tells us that whilst crossing the Mander at Bitterbridge, he passed Septon Barth coming in the other direction. Barth was alone, riding on a donkey. The young king's changes went well beyond the nobles who sat upon his council. He made a clean sweep of dozens of lesser offices as well, replacing the Keeper of the Keys, the chief steward of the Red Keep, and all his understewards, the harbour master of King's Landing, and in time the harbour masters of Oldtown, Maidenpool, and Duskendale as well, the warden of the king's mint, the king's justice, the master-at-arms, kennel-master, master of horse, and even the castle rat-catchers. He further commanded that the dungeons beneath the Red Keep be cleaned and emptied out, and that all the prisoners found in the black cells be brought up into the sun, bathed, and allowed to make appeal. Some, he feared, might well be innocent men imprisoned by his uncle. In this, Jaehaerys proved sadly correct, though many of those captives had gone quite mad during their years in darkness and could not be released. Only when all this had been done to his satisfaction and his new men were in place did Jaehaerys instruct Grand Maester Bennifer to dispatch a raven to Storm's End, summoning Lord Rhaegar Baratheon back to the city. The arrival of the king's letter set Lord Rhaegar and his brothers at odds. Ser Boris, oft considered the most volatile and belligerent of the Baratheons, proved the calmest in this instance. "The boy will have your head if you do as he bids," he said. "Go to the wall. The Night's Watch will take you." Garen and Ronald, the younger brothers, urged defiance instead. Storm's End was strong as any castle in the realm. If Jaehaerys meant to have his head, let him come and take it, they said. Lord Rhaegar only laughed at that. "Strong," he said. "Harrenhal was strong. No, I will see Jaehaerys first, and explain myself. I can take the black then if I choose. He will not deny me that." The next morning he set off for King's Landing, accompanied only by 6 of his oldest knights, men who had known him since childhood. The king received him, seated on the Iron Throne with his crown upon his head. The lords of his council were present, and Sir Geoffrey Doggett and Sir Lawrence Roxton of the King's Guard stood at the base of the throne in their white cloaks and enamelled scale. Elsewise, the throne room was empty. Lord Rogar's footsteps echoed as he made the long walk from the doors to the throne, Grand Maester Benifer tells us. His lordship's pride was well known to the king, he wrote. His grace had no wish to wound him further by forcing him to humble himself before the entire court. Humble himself he did, however. The Lord of Storm's End fell to one knee, bowed his head, and laid his sword at the base of the throne. "Your grace," he began, "I am here as you commanded. Do as you will with me. I ask only that you spare my brothers and House Baratheon. All that I did for the good of the realm as you saw it." Jaehaerys raised a hand to silence Lord Rogar before he could say further. "I know what you did, and what you said, and what you planned. I believe you when you say you meant no harm to my person or to my queen. And you are not wrong. I would make a splendid maester. But I hope to make an even better king. Some men say that we are now enemies. I would sooner think of us as friends who disagreed. When my mother came to you seeking refuge, you took us in at great risk to yourself. You could have easily clapped us in chains and made a gift of us to my uncle. Instead, you swore your sword to me and called your banners. I have not forgotten." "Words are wind," Jaehaerys went on. "Your lordship, my dear friend, spoke of treason, but committed none. You wished to undo my marriage, but you could not do so. You suggested placing Princess Arya upon the Iron Throne in my place, but here I sit. You did send your brother to remove my niece Rhaela from her mother house, true, but for what purpose? Perhaps you only wished to have her for a ward, lacking any child of your own. Treasonous actions deserve punishment. Foolish words are another matter. If you truly desire to go to the wall, I will not stop you. The Night's Watch needs men as strong as you. But I would sooner you remain here, in my service. I would not sit upon this throne if not for you. All the realm knows that. And I still have need of you. The realm has need of you. When the dragon died and my father donned the crown, he was beset on all sides by would-be kings and rebel lords. The same may befall me, and for the same reason, to test my resolve, my will, my strength. My mother believes that godly men throughout the realm will rise against me when my marriage is made known. Mayhap so. To meet these tests, I need good men around me, warriors willing to fight for me, to die for me, and for my queen, if need be. Are you such a man?" Lord Rogar, thunderstruck at the king's words, looked up and said, "I am, your grace," in a voice thick with emotion. "Then I pardon your offences," King Jaehaerys said. "But there will be certain conditions," his voice grew stern as he listed them. "You will never speak another word against me or my queen. From this day forth, you shall be her loudest champion and suffer no word to be spoken against her in your presence. Furthermore, I cannot and will not suffer my mother to be disrespected. She will return with you to Storm's End, where you will live as husband and wife once again. In word and deed you will show her only honour and courtesy. Can you abide by these conditions?" "Gladly," said Lord Rogar. "Might I ask, what of Orin?" That gave the king pause. "I shall command Lord Hightower to free your brother, Ser Orin, and the men who went with him to Old Town," Jaehaerys said. "But I cannot allow them to go unpunished. The wall is forever, so instead I will sentence them to 10 years of exile. They can sell their swords in the disputed lands, or sail to Carth to make their fortunes. It matters not to me. If they survive and commit no further crimes, in 10 years' time they can come home. Are we agreed?" "We are," Lord Rogar responded. "Your grace is more than just." Then he asked if the king would require hostages of him as a surety of his future loyalty. 3 of his brothers had young children who could be sent to court, he pointed out. In answer, King Jaehaerys descended the Iron Throne and bade Lord Rogar follow him. He led his lordship from the hall to the inner ward, where Vermithor was being fed. A bull had been slaughtered for his morning meal and lay upon the stones charred and smoking, for dragons always burn their meat before consuming it. Vermithor was feasting on the flesh, tearing loose great chunks of meat with each bite, but when the king approached with Lord Rogar, the dragon raised his head and gazed at them with eyes like pools of molten bronze. "He grows larger every day," Jaehaerys said as he scratched the great worm under his jaw. "Keep your nieces and your nephews, my lord. Why would I need hostages? I have your word. That is all that I require." But Grand Maester Bennifer heard the words he did not speak. "Every man and maid and child in the Stormlands is my hostage whilst I ride him," his grace said, without saying, wrote Bennifer. And Lord Rogar heard him plain. Thus was the peace made between the young king and his former hand, and sealed that night by a feast in the great hall, where Lord Rogar sat beside Queen Alyssa, man and wife once more, and raised a toast to the health of Queen Alysanne, pledging her his love and loyalty before all the assembled lords and ladies. 4 days later, when Lord Rogar departed to return to Storm's End, Queen Alyssa went with him, escorted by Sir Pate the Woodcock and 100 men-at-arms to see them safe through the Kingswood. Sir Orin Baratheon never did return to Westeros. Together with the men who had accompanied him to Old Town, he crossed to the free city of Tyrosh, where he took service with the Archon. A year later he married the Archon's daughter, the very maid his brother Rogar had hoped to wed to King Jaehaerys as a means of securing an alliance between the Iron Throne and the Free City. A buxom maid with blue-green hair and a winsome manner, Sauron's wife soon gave him a daughter, though there was some doubt whether the girl was truly his, for like many women of the Free Cities, she was free with her favour. When her father's term as Archon ended, Sir Orin lost his position as well and was forced to leave Tyrosh for Myr, where he joined the Maiden's Men, a free company with an especially unsavoury reputation. He was killed soon afterward in the disputed lands during a battle with the Men of Valor. We have no knowledge of the fate of his wife and daughter. In King's Landing, the long reign of Jaehaerys I Targaryen began in earnest. The young king faced a score of problems when he assumed the rule of the Seven Kingdoms, but two loomed larger than all the rest. The treasury was empty, and the crown's debt was mounting, and his secret marriage, which grew less secret with every passing day, sat like a jar of wildfire on a hearth, waiting to explode. Both questions needed to be dealt with, and quickly. The immediate need for gold was resolved by Rigo Draz, the new master of coin, who reached out to the Iron Bank of Braavos and its rivals in Tyrosh and Myr to arrange not one but three substantial loans. By playing each bank against the others, the Lord of Air negotiated as favourable terms as might be hoped for. The securing of the loans had one immediate effect. Work on the Dragon Pit was able to resume, and once again a small army of builders and stonemasons swarmed over the Hill of Rhaenys. Lord Rigo and his king both realized that the loans were a stopgap measure at best, however. They might slow the bleeding, but they would not staunch the wound. Only taxes could accomplish that. Lord Celtigar's taxes would not serve. Jaehaerys had no interest in raising port fees or bleeding innkeeps, nor would he simply demand gold from the lords of the realm as Maegor had. Too much of that, and the lords would rise up. "Nothing is so costly as putting down rebellions," the king declared. The lords would pay, but of their own free will. He would tax the things they wanted, fine and costly things from across the sea. Silk would be taxed, and samite, cloth of gold and cloth of silver, gemstones, Mirish lace and Mirish tapestries, Dornish wines, but not wines from the arbour, Dornish sand steeds, gilded helms and filigreed armour from the craftsmen of Tyrosh, Lys and Pentos. Spices would be taxed, heaviest of all. Peppercorns, cloves, saffron, nutmeg, cinnamon, and all the other rare seasonings from beyond the Jade Gates, already more costly than gold, would become still costlier. "We are taxing all the things that made me rich," Lord Rigo japed. "No man can claim to be oppressed by these taxes," Jaehaerys explained to the small council. "To avoid them, a man need only forego his pepper, his silk, his pearls, and he need not pay a groat. The men who want these things desire them desperately, however. How else to flaunt their power and show the world what wealthy men they are? They may squawk, but they will pay." The spice and silk taxes were not the end of it. King Jaehaerys also brought forth a new law on crenellations. Any lord who wished to build a new castle or expand and repair his existing seat would need to pay a hefty price for the privilege. The new tax served a dual purpose, His Grace explained to Grand Maester Bennifer. The larger and stronger a castle, the more its lord is tempted to defy me. You would think they might learn from Black Harren, but too many do not know their history. This tax will discourage them from building, whilst those who must build regardless can replenish our treasury whilst they empty theirs. Having done what he could to repair the crown's finances, His Grace turned his attention to the other great matter awaiting him. At long last, he sent for his queen. Alysanne Targaryen and her dragon Silverwing departed Dragonstone within an hour of his summons, after having been apart from the king for nigh on half a year. The rest of her household followed by ship. By this time, even blind beggars in the alleys of Flea Bottom knew that Alysanne and Jaehaerys had been wed, but for the sake of propriety the king and queen slept separately for a moon's turn, whilst preparations were made for their second wedding. The king was not disposed to spend coin he did not have on another golden wedding, as splendid and popular as that event had been. 40,000 had witnessed his mother marry Lord Rhaegar. 1,000 came together in the Red Keep to see Jaehaerys take his sister Alysanne to wife again. This time it was Septon Barth who pronounced them man and wife beneath the Iron Throne. Lord Rhaegar Baratheon and the Dowager Queen Alysa were amongst those standing witness this time. Together with his lordship's brothers Garen and Ronald, they had made their way back from Storm's End to attend the ceremony. But it was another wedding guest who excited the most talk. The Queen in the West had come as well. Born on the wings of Dreamfire, Rhaena Targaryen had flown in to see her siblings wed, and to visit her daughter Arya. Bells rang throughout the city as the rites were concluded, and a flight of ravens took wing to every corner of the realm to proclaim this happy union. The king's second wedding differed from his first in one other crucial respect. It was followed by a bedding. Queen Alysanne, in later years, would declare that this was at her insistence. She was ready to lose her maidenhead, and she wanted no more questions as to whether she were truly married. Lord Rhaegar himself, a roaring drunk, led the men who disrobed her and carried her to the bridal bed, whilst the queen's companions, Jenys Templeton, Rosamund Ball, and Prudence and Prunella Celtigar, were amongst those who did the honours for the king. There, upon a canopied bed in Maegor's Holdfast, in the Red Keep of King's Landing, the marriage of Jaehaerys Targaryen and his sister Alysanne was consummated at long last, sealing their union for all time before the eyes of gods and men. With secrecy finally at an end, the king and his court waited to see how the realm would respond. Jaehaerys had concluded that the violent opposition that had greeted his brother Aegon's marriage had several causes. Their uncle Maegor's taking of a second wife in 39 AC, in defiance of both the High Septon and his own brother King Aenys, had shattered the delicate understanding between the Iron Throne and the Starry Sept, so the marriage of Aegon and Rhaena had been seen as a further outrage. The denunciation thus provoked had lit a fire across the land, and the Swords and Stars had taken up the torches, along with a score of pious lords who feared the gods more than their king. Prince Aegon and Princess Rhaena had been little known amongst the small folk, and they had begun their progress without dragons, in large part because Aegon was not yet a dragon rider, which left them vulnerable to the mobs that sprung up to attack them in the Riverlands. None of these conditions applied to Jaehaerys and Alysanne. There would be no denunciation from the Starry Sept, whilst some amongst the most devout still bristled at the Targaryen tradition of sibling marriage. The present High Septon, Septon Moon's High Lickspittle, was complacent and cautious, not inclined to wake sleeping dragons. The Swords and Stars had been broken and outlawed, only at the Wall, where 2,000 former poor fellows now wore the black cloaks of the Night's Watch, did they have sufficient numbers to be troublesome, were they so inclined. And King Jaehaerys was not about to repeat his brother's mistake. He and his queen meant to see the land they ruled, to learn its needs firsthand, to meet his lords and take their measure, to let themselves be seen by the small folk and to hear their griefs in turn. But wherever they went, it would be with their dragons. For all these reasons, Jaehaerys believed that the realm would accept his marriage. But he was not a man to trust in chance. "Words are wind," he told his council, "but wind can fan a fire. My father and my uncle fought words with steel and flame. We shall fight words with words, and put out the fires before they start." And so saying, his grace sent forth not knights and men-at-arms, but preachers. "Tell every man you meet of Alysanne's kindness, her sweet and gentle nature, and her love for all the people of our kingdom, great and small," the king charged them. 7 went forth at his command, 3 men and 4 women. In place of swords and axes they were armed only with their wits, their courage, and their tongues. Many a tale would be told of their travels, and their exploits would become legends, growing vastly larger in the process, as is the way of legends. Only one of the 7 speakers was known to the common folks of the realm when they set out. No less a person than Queen Eleanor herself, the black bride who had found Maegor dead upon the Iron Throne. Clad in her queenly raiment, which grew shabbier and more threadbare by the day, Eleanor of House Costain would travel the Reach, giving eloquent testimony to the evil of her late king and the goodness of his successors. In later years, giving up all claims to nobility, she would join the faith, rising eventually to become Mother Eleanor at the great mother house in Lannisport. The names of the other 6 who went forth to speak for Jaehaerys would in time become nigh as famous as the queen's. 3 were young Septons, cunning Septon Baldric, learned Septon Rollo, and fierce old Septon Alfin, who had lost his legs years before and was carried everywhere in a litter. The women the young king chose were no less extraordinary. Septa Isabel had been won over by Queen Alysanne whilst serving her on Dragonstone. Diminutive Septa Violante was renowned for her skills as a healer. Everywhere she went it was said she performed miracles. From the Vale came Mother Maris, who had taught generations of orphan girls at a mother house on an island in Gulltown's harbour. In their travels throughout the realm, the 7 speakers talked of Queen Alysanne, her piety, her generosity, and her love for the king, her brother. But for those Septons, begging brothers and pious knights and lords, who challenged them by citing passages from the 7-pointed star, or the sermons of high Septons past, they had a ready answer, one that Jaehaerys himself had crafted in King's Landing, ably assisted by Septon Oswick and, especially, Septon Barth. In later years, the Citadel and the Starry Sept alike would call it the Doctrine of Exceptionalism. Its basic tenet was simple. The faith of the 7 had been born in the hills of Andalos of old, and had crossed the narrow sea with the Andals. The laws of the 7, as laid down in sacred text and taught by the Septors and Septons in obedience to the Father of the Faithful, decreed that brother might not lie with sister, nor father with daughter, nor mother with son, that the fruits of such unions were abominations, loathsome in the eyes of the gods. All this the exceptionalists affirmed. But with this caveat, the Targaryens were different. Their roots were not in Andalos, but in Valyria of old, where different laws and traditions held sway. A man had only to look at them to know that they were not like other men. Their eyes, their hair, their very bearing all proclaimed their differences. And they flew dragons. They alone of all the men in the world had been given the power to tame those fearsome beasts, once the doom had come to Valyria. "One God made us all, Andals and Valyrians and First Men," Septon Alfin would proclaim from his litter, "but he did not make us all alike. He made the lion and the aurochs as well, both noble beasts, but certain gifts he gave to one and not the other, and the lion cannot live as an aurochs, nor an aurochs as a lion. For you to bed your sister would be a grievous sin, sir. But you are not the blood of the dragon no more than I am. What they do is what they have always done, and it is not for us to judge them." Legend tells us that in one small village the quick-witted Septon Baldric was confronted by a burly hedge knight, once a poor fellow, who said, "Aye, and if I want to fuck my sister too, do I have your leave?" The Septon smiled and replied, "Go to Dragonstone and claim a dragon. If you can do that, sir, I will marry you and your sister myself." Here is a quandary, every student of history must face. When looking back upon the things that happened in years past, we can say, this and this and this were the causes of what occurred. When looking back on things that did not happen, however, we have only surmise. We know the realm did not rise up against King Jaehaerys and Queen Alysanne in 51 AC as it had against Aegon and Rhaena 10 years earlier. The why of it is a good deal less certain. The High Septon's silence spoke loudly, no doubt, and the lords and common folk alike were weary of war. But if words have power, wind or no, surely the seven speakers played a part as well. Though the king was happy in his queen and the realm happy with their marriage, Jaehaerys had not been wrong when he foresaw that he would face a time of testing. Having remade the council, reconciled Lord Rhaegar and Queen Alysa, and imposed new taxes to restore the crown's coffers, he was faced with what would prove to be his thorniest problem yet, his sister Rhaena. Since taking her leave of Lyman Lannister and Casterly Rock, Rhaena Targaryen and her travelling court had made their own royal progress of sorts, visiting the Marbrands of Ashmark, the Rains of Castamere, the Leffords at the Golden Tooth, the Vances at Wayfarer's Rest, and finally the Pipers of Pinkmaiden. No matter where she turned, the same problems arose. They are all warm at first, she told her brother when she met with him after his wedding, but it does not last. Either I am unwelcome or too welcome. They murmur of the cost of keeping me and mine, but it is Dreamfire who excites them. Some fear her, more want her, and it is those who trouble me most. They lust for dragons of their own. That I will not give them. But where am I to go? Here, the king suggested, return to court. And live forever in your shadow? I need a seat of my own, a place where no lord may threaten me, banish me, or trouble those I have taken under my protection. I need lands, men, a castle. We can find you lands, the king said. Build you a castle. All the lands are taken, all the castles occupied, Rhaena replied. But there is one I have a claim to, a better claim than your own, brother. I am the blood of the dragon. I want my father's seat, the place where I was born. I want Dragonstone. To that, King Jaehaerys had no answer, promising only to take the matter under consideration. His council, when the question was put to them, were united in their opposition to ceding the ancestral seat of House Targaryen to the widowed queen, but none had any better solution to offer. After reflecting on the matter, His Grace met with his sister again. "I will grant you Dragonstone as your seat," he told her, "for there is no place more fitting for the blood of the dragon. But you shall hold the island and the castle by my gift, not by right. Our grandsire made 7 kingdoms into 1, with fire and blood. I cannot and will not make them 2 by carving you off a separate kingdom of your own. You are a queen by courtesy, but I am king. And my writ runs from Old Town to the Wall, and on Dragonstone as well. Are we of one mind on this, sister? Are you so uncertain of that iron seat that you must needs have your own blood bend the knee to your brother? Rhaena threw back at him. So be it. Give me Dragonstone and one thing more, and I shall trouble you no further. One thing more? Jaehaerys asked. Arya, I want my daughter restored to me. Done, the king said. Mayhaps too hastily, for it must be remembered that Arya Targaryen, a girl of 8, was his own acknowledged successor, heir apparent to the Iron Throne. The consequences of this decision would not be known for years to come, however. For the nonce, it was done, and the queen in the west, at a stroke, became the queen in the east. The year continued without further crisis or test as Jaehaerys and Alysanne settled in to rule. If certain members of the small council were taken aback when the queen began to attend their meetings, they voiced their objections only to one another. And soon not even that, for the young queen proved to be wise, well-read and clever, a welcome voice in any discussion. Alysanne Targaryen had happy memories of her childhood before her uncle Maegor seized the crown. During the reign of her father, Aenys, her mother, Queen Alysa, had made the court a splendid place, filled with song, spectacle, and beauty. Musicians, mummers, and bards competed for her favour and that of the king. Wines from the arbour flowed like water at their feasts. The halls and yards of Dragonstone rang with laughter, and the women of the court dazzled in pearls and diamonds. Magor's court had been a grim, dark place.